take what's good. Ooh, 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 what's good. Ooh, 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 ooh.
You're listening to the Fearless Kitchen Podcast. And now it's time to join your host, Vanessa Baxter.
Hi there and welcome to another episode of The Fearless Kitchen brought to you by worldpodcast.com. My awesome partners, love them, love them. So I'm very excited because we have gone across the world with today's guest and I am going to be chatting with Christy Harrison, who I discovered through her Food Psych podcast online. It's a podcast which is dedicated to helping people make peace with their body and with food, and she talks with really inspiring guests from all over the world about being body positive, about intuitive eating, eating disorder recovery, you know, the whole weight stigma and fat acceptance, nutrition. It's amazing. I love her because she's really anti-diet and it's all about challenging that diet culture that we have found ourselves in and those real restrictive behaviours. It kind of drives me crazy. It's a real pain point for me. And in this chat with Christy, it was quite lovely to talk with her because I think we're very much on the same wavelength in how we feel about people and obsessions around food. So I'm really, really thrilled to bring you this chat. You'll find out so much about Christy in our chat here, her background and how she has built her business, but also her passion for helping others just be relaxed around food, love their life, and all that goes with that. So I'm really excited to introduce her. Here is my chat brought again to you through the Fearless Kitchen and World podcasts. Here is Christy Harrison. So thank you for making the time. I know lots about you because I've been following your podcast, but you probably don't know a lot about me.
No, yeah. I was excited to discover a new podcast.
Yeah, that's awesome.
I have not had a chance to listen yet.
But. That's okay. That's okay. So mine is very broad in comparison to yours. Yours is amazing and I absolutely love it. And I tapped into yours because at my end here in New Zealand, you know, we've got this massive issue, of course, similar to your situation in the States with obesity, but also battling of food disorders and people really confused at the moment. And I'm all about being fearless in the kitchen, totally not into diets or fads or trends, but just reminding people not to be fearful around food and to not sort of tap into all this negative energy that goes, because I am myself, I was myself as a young woman, you know, anorexic, and I know how absolutely detrimental that can be for so many people. And it worries me, all this kind of fad dieting and negativity and people putting pressure on others about what they should and shouldn't eat. And I thought, there's got to be people in the States who are all over this because we're down here in New Zealand. And I found you and I have been listening to so many of your amazing guests. And I actually, Christy, tapped into one of your episodes where you interviewed someone, and I'm sorry for her because I can't remember her name, but she described how much she loved ballet and how being a classical dancer had affected, of course, her perception of how her body needed to be, and she ended up with an eating disorder, but came out the other side and is really committed to the whole mindful eating philosophy and just being happy with herself. And I completely connected with that because I did ballet and all of those things that she was talking about, and I went, oh my gosh, I love her, I love you, and how amazing it would be to have you on the show and share with some people in New Zealand, and I have listeners from all over the world, but to share with us your views all around your philosophy on not, similarly to me, not tapping into this whole sort of fear of food factor that seems to be huge. Like there's sort of a movement that has been created almost without people realizing that's what's going on.
Totally. Yeah, the fear of food movement. That's very true.
It's true, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's really sad. So could you introduce yourself, let us know who you are and what you've been doing and why you've ended up doing what you're doing, because I know you have your own story, and just, yeah, share with my listeners what your story is and where and your background and how you've ended up doing what you're doing today.
Sure, yeah. So I started out, I'll say that now I am a dietitian and a certified intuitive eating counselor and also a podcaster, like you said. And I started out as a journalist. So I'm kind of doing journalism still in my role as a podcaster, but I started out in print and online media. And this was back in 2003. I graduated college when, you know, the sort of organic and sustainable food movement was just starting up. And I was struggling with an eating disorder. I developed an eating disorder my junior year of college. And it was the sort of restrict binge cycle type of eating disorder. And it was not diagnosed until much later. And so I was sort of struggling in silence with this eating disorder and deciding what to do. You know, I wanted to be a journalist. I was always a writer, knew that I wanted to write for a very long time, but I was sort of trying to decide what area of journalism to go into, what my beat was going to be. And so I stumbled on to environmental journalism and writing about the organic food movement and this sort of Michael Pollan, you know, sustainable food industry thing was really lighting my fire. So I decided like food politics and environmental journalism would be my thing. And I started working for a magazine in New York. I moved to New York and was covering food for them and got really excited about not just writing about food politics and, you know, farming and sustainability, which I loved, but also just sort of the culinary aspects of food. And that was actually a really big first step out of the disordered eating for me was, well, I should say also actually another first step before that was that I dated a guy who was also a food writer and a food lover, like a foodie, although he really distanced himself from that term even at the time. But, you know, he was really into food, really into restaurants. We would do a lot of food tours together. And so that, you know, being in that relationship was like exposure therapy to me, kind of. It was helping me be more normal around food when I was with him, because I had this very codependent tendency back then too, which was, you know, to be the person that my partner wanted me to be at all times. Uh-huh. And so that, you know, really works against you in a lot of areas of life, and certainly in having a healthy relationship, I would not recommend it, but that was a good, you know, it had a sort of silver lining for me in terms of my relationship with food, because I was, you know, motivated to not show him the disordered behaviors and the disordered side of myself. And so I really did sort of rise to the occasion and eat with him in an adventurous way when we were together. And the relationship got more and more serious, and we moved to New York at the same time, you know, together, but we didn't live together right away, or we didn't live together ever. But we started spending more and more time together. We were eating pretty much all of our meals together, except when I was at work at lunch. And so, you know, it just sort of eased me into this way of eating that was more structured and more adventurous and, you know, eating more, right? Yeah, nourishing exactly. myself more than I would have on my own, than I was doing on my own. Sure. And then I started also writing about food. And so, you know, working as a freelancer, writing about food for various publications, I was having to go like taste, you know, men go to tasting events or go to a restaurant and write about it. And I was also still writing about sustainability and farming and organics and stuff like that. But I was starting to branch out to more of a culinary, you know, focus as well.
Isn't that funny, Christy?
So then I ended up getting a job at Gourmet Magazine as an editor there. And I had broken up with that boyfriend a while before and started therapy at the end of after that breakup, because it caused some, you know, emotional stuff that I needed to process. And so I was working with this therapist when I started working at Gourmet, and, you know, for 10 years or something worked with the same therapist. And so when I was working at Gourmet, I was again, you know, thrown into this workplace where I was exposed to lots of different kinds of foods. I was sort of required to rise to the occasion. I wanted to be seen as someone who was adventurous and up for anything. And I didn't want to be labeled as like a weirdo or a dieter. And that was, you know, being someone who was restrictive was seen as very not cool at that place, you know. And I'm good at picking up on vibes of what people want from me, because that's another codependent trait. So I was kind of like, okay, this workplace does not allow any of that to happen, and I will be, you know, very ashamed if I sort of expose that part of my myself, my issues with food here. So I'm going to just not talk about that and be very up for anything and sort of struggling, you know, behind the scenes. Certainly, like when I went home, I would be like, what have I done? And, you know, have all these thoughts about, you know, negative thoughts about how I was eating and my body. And, you know, I was still over-exercising a bit there, but also this job took up so much of my time. Like, we were launching the website for Gourmet. And so I'd sometimes be there until 5 a.m, you know, like it was just, there wasn't a lot of space for anything else. And so I didn't actually have much time for engaging in disordered behaviors on my own even. and that really did, you know, help stop the behaviors, but of course it didn't stop the thoughts. And I was starting to work on the thoughts in therapy with that therapist once I finally sort of trusted her enough, because side note, like back in the day when I had first tried to reach out to someone for my eating disorder, like my senior year of college, I was told, you're not thin enough to have an eating disorder. That can't be what this is. And that very much shut me down and, you know, made me feel ashamed and also sort of angry, like I'll show her what's thin enough, you know. And
yes.
It, of course, is now looking back on it, I can see that's an example of a very weight stigmatizing point of view and not really understanding what eating disorders are. But, you know, it made me feel like I couldn't open up to any other therapist about this issue. So it took me quite a while in building up a lot of trust with the therapist I finally did open up to about that. But then, you know, as I did, I started to work with her on some of the underlying issues, as well as sort of experiment with, you know, allowing myself to eat and being more free and having more permission with food. Because, you know, again, I was actually eating the food when I was at Gourmet, but like on my off hours and, you know, behind the scenes, feeling extremely guilty about it and doing some sort of low level restriction and dieting. So we really worked on that in therapy. And then I sort of heard that where there were some rumors afoot that they were going to close the magazine. It was 2008. There was this global recession afoot and people and magazines were being closed left and right. And so I decided to sort of take stock of what I was doing and look to industries other than journalism for what I might be able to do, and wanted to go back to school to get a degree in something else. And sort of given my experience with writing about food and nutrition and food policy and politics, I was really interested in what Marion Nessel was doing. And she is at NYU in the Department of Nutrition, Food Studies, and Public Health. So I was like, I want to study with Marion Nessel. I want to do something related to changing the food system and also maybe working with individuals on their relationships with food. So there's sort of like a two-pronged idea of what I could do. And I went back to school at NYU to study public health and nutrition and get my dietitian's license. And it was there somewhere along the way, probably not in any of my classes, but some independent research I was doing on my own, that I discovered Intuitive Eating, the book. And when I read it, it really plugged right into a lot of the work I had been doing in therapy already and to my childhood of growing up as an intuitive eater, because I had that privilege. I was lucky to grow up without pressure from my family to eat any differently than I wanted to. And, you know, my intuitive eating was really sort of fostered. So when I read that book, it sort of made a lot of sense to me. And that was kind of the final, probably the final nail in the coffin of my eating disorder, I would say. It was, you know, discovering intuitive eating and kind of implementing its principles in my own life. And it wasn't until years later that I started practicing intuitive eating in my professional life and using that to treat clients. Because even when I first started as a dietitian, I was actually doing sort of traditional wellness stuff. I was not sort of attuned to the fact that intuitive eating is something that's good for everyone. I was like, well, that helped me in my own relationship with food, but there's a quote unquote obesity epidemic afoot and I need to help solve it. So like, you know, that's a point of view that most health professionals are steeped in this day and age. And that was something I very much bought into at first. So, you know, I started the podcast. And that was actually how I started to shift my thinking as to like who intuitive eating is really for, because people were contacting me from around the world being like, hey, your podcast is really helping me with my eating disorder. And, you know, it's helping me start to recover. So that was when I decided, like, I think I want to specialize in eating disorders and have that be sort of one of the main focuses in my private practice. And I got some training in that, and since discovered like intuitive eating and the sort of later stage recovery work is like really where my heart is. So that's now what I do, is intuitive eating coaching with people who are ready to give up dieting, who are done with, you know, the real acute part of their eating disorder, but are still maybe struggling with some disordered eating or dieting, or just are, you know, have a history of chronic dieting and want to give that up. So yeah, that's kind of how I got from A to B in a very long storyline that could probably be much longer, but I'm trying to,
no, you know, it's beautiful. Keep it simple. Thank you so much for sharing that. I think that's just so important for people to hear. I mean, in one line of what you were doing, you were like this highly successful person who people would look at and go, oh, that's all I want to do is work for Gourmet Magazine. And how amazing and how lucky probably is she. Mm-hmm. And meantime, you're struggling and grappling with the thing, which is you're working for the top food magazine in the States, and people are perceiving that you're lucky and have this amazing job. And meantime, you know in your heart that you're actually struggling. You're immersed in the food world and you're struggling with an eating disorder. I mean, that's just, yeah, you know, that's crazy. But do you think, Christy, and all the people that you've met along the way, and I've interviewed so many food lovers who will then either on air or off air admit to me that they come from a background of eating disorders, and it seems like a massive correlation of people who are really fascinated, and I use obsessed in a lovely way, around food, actually possibly also had some kind of eating fascination or disorder when they were younger, and it's all part and parcel of that kind of.
Absolutely.
Yeah. It's amazing.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. I had that experience too of being, you know, very obsessed with food because of the restriction that I was doing, and, you know, having it sort of sharpen my attention and focus towards food, where I had never really cared that much about food before the eating disorder. And I stumbled on a paper that you may know of or have read about. It's called the Minnesota Starvation Experiment. And it was done in the 1940s, back before there were institutional review boards that would never allow this to happen today, this kind of study. But it was done with conscientious objectors to World War II, had them come in and put them on a semi-starvation diet, so like half of what they determined that their bodies needed, and then observe the results for a year. So it was like this year-long experiment in what would happen to people in situations of starvation. And they were using the data to try to help with you know, hunger relief efforts in Europe after World War II. So it was done for a really good cause, you know, but these people were, you know, they were tested for their psychological health going into this experiment, and they didn't have any underlying eating disorders or conditions that would make them vulnerable to some of the psychological stuff that happened. But it was like amazing to see how, and these were men also, so they didn't have cultural pressures the way that women did at the time and still do. Although men are, you know, people of all genders increasingly have these pressures. But, you know, these were men that were selected for their supposed invulnerability to eating issues. And what happened was that they became completely obsessed with food. There were a lot of like hoarding behaviors and binging and weird food behaviors like you might see in an eating disorder of, you know, cutting food up into little pieces or weird food rituals. And one upshot of this was also that many of the men, these were all college age men, changed their careers to focus on food in some way. Some of them became chefs. Some of them went into like farming or agriculture. You know, there were just these different ways that food was so important to them. And there was this culture of like trading recipes and talking about food all the time within this, you know, cohort that was experiencing starvation.
That
really, you know, the researchers in that paper sort of made that observation. Like, it seems like it you know, attuned their attention to food in this way that hadn't happened before and changed the course of some of their lives. And I really resonated with that because I was like, that is for sure what happened for me. And I think a lot of people, I've talked to so many people also who now work in like the food or nutrition or health fields that have struggled with their own eating disorders too. I think it's no coincidence. Like, this correlation has to mean something. And I think that's what it means, that the effects of starvation on the brain or restriction, and these were people that weren't even like in full starvation, you know, semi-starvation. It was actually, I mean, I'm not going to say numbers and I don't recommend actually looking at the research because it has some really bad ideas, but, yes. You know, trigger warning on that. But like the calorie level that they were fed was what a lot of diets are today, you know, what a lot of, and, you know, these were college age men, right? So probably their energy needs were higher, but they were, you know, extremely symptomatic of disordered eating on these diets that are now being prescribed to people like, oh, this is a healthy diet. This is how you should eat to lose weight or to be healthy. So, yeah. Anyway, that's just extremely fascinating to me.
Well, it is extremely fascinating. And I, you know, because I did do the yo-yo dieting, which, you know, is another symptom, isn't it, of that sort of eating disorder and not quite sure how to take control of it. And I was very similar to you, that no one really talked to me about my eating disorder. So I thought I couldn't be bad enough yet. I couldn't be skinny enough yet. So I need to get skinnier, you know. I mean, it's just such a completely screwed up psychological thing. And I was studying psych at uni at the time and have ended up in food, you know. So I didn't, I mean, obviously I use my psych in what I do nowadays in working with others, but such a similar story to yours. And that study just sounds amazing. And that is what underpins my fear for people now who are so caught up in fads, which in my mind are restrictive eating, that especially if they're imposing it upon children, that we're going to see another whole generation come through with some really, really scary psychological issues around food. Do you feel like that?
Absolutely. Yeah, I think it's really frightening to see what's happening now because, you know, I think the upshot of that sort of Michael Pollan, Marion Nestle, you know, focus on food politics and sustainability that has become so mainstream now is that some people who are vulnerable to very perfectionistic thinking about food and who really bought into diet culture take that as justification for orthorexia, really, which is, you know, unhealthy obsession with healthy eating, like clean eating or, you know, counting your macros or paleo or all of these different things that are sort of focused on like less processed, quote unquote, foods and, you know, demonizing certain foods and elevating others. You know, these are the people who are now becoming parents and raising kids in that environment. And, you know, I've had parents bring their kids in to see me and they say like, well, we don't eat sugar in our household or we don't, you know, there's all these restrictions on what's allowed in the house, right? We don't have processed food or we don't have, you know, any sort of grain or whatever. Yes. Like, you know, these kids are just so vulnerable and at such an age when this can really shape and destroy their relationships with food going forward. And parents are doing the best they can, but they're stuck in their own disorder as well. And they're struggling with this stuff as well. And so they're transmitting this really unhelpful misinformation onto kids in a way that just hurts everyone. So, you know, and again, not to like demonize anyone for doing that. I have so much compassion for parents who are doing the best they can, but also struggling with their own stuff around food and thinking that that's a healthy way to be, but actually depriving your kids of sugar is a great way to set them up for eating disorders and disordered eating, like binging on sugar or, you know, very compulsive relationships with particular foods. And same with, you know, depriving them of anything, really. It's so much better for a kid's relationship with food to have access to everything and to be able to say what they want and not have restrictions placed on what can be, you know, what types of nutrients are allowed, than, you know, trying to be too perfectionistic about it.
Yeah, I mean, that's how I feel as well. And I feel that there's so much conversation around it. And while I don't disagree with chatting with kids, and I coach families here around getting kids eating and happy and less fearful of all their foods and jumping into the kitchen, and I try to teach cooking for kids to encourage them to be actively involved rather than it just being forced upon them one way or another. So rather than just constantly giving them the information, I feel most people know what's right to feed their kids in general, not the ones we've just been discussing, but in general, everyone knows a more healthy approach is to eat as much fresh food as possible. So we don't have to keep hammering that point at people, but my approach is to try to be more hands-on and practical and jump in with some families and just show them some really easy tips and tricks in the kitchen to be able to cook a family meal quickly and get the kids involved as well. So it just becomes more, as you and I probably grew up, just more normal without this constant feeling of a need to say, oh, you shouldn't eat that and that's the right thing and did you know what's in this? And because then we're just kind of creating more of an obsession around everyone needing to talk about it all the time, which is, really quite depressing actually.
No, I totally agree.
Yeah. So how do you, with families that come in like that, Christy, how do you encourage them on the journey of intuitive eating without the way your terminology is and the way you're describing with me is so beautiful and positive. So how do you help these families on the journey of more intuitive or mindful eating and steering them gently away from restrictive? How do you go about that?
Yeah, I mean, I will say that I work primarily with adults. So yes. Like, you know, the children I work with are not as, you know, or more few and far between, but I work with a lot of adults who have families as well. And yes. I think the real starting point has to be with the parents. You know, I think for the parents to be able to recognize what has been going on in their own relationship with food that they might be transmitting to their kids is a huge piece of recovery. And I'm not talking about full-blown eating disorders in kids. You know, I have seen some kids who struggle with full-blown eating disorders and I've sort of moved into just pure intuitive eating coaching at this point. So I don't work with that population much anymore. But, you know, when a kid has a full-blown eating disorder and is really struggling, obviously they need treatment, they need their own nutritionist, they need their own therapist, you know, if possible. And obviously it's coming from a place of huge privilege if people are able to do that. So I understand that some families are not able to afford that. But, you know, in New Zealand, like you have healthcare, right? So, you know, you can get on the list for eating disorder treatment for your child, for example. But, you know, if it's more that gray area, if it's more like disordered eating, dieting, et cetera, not quite, you know, the child is not struggling with a full-blown eating disorder, but more just like somewhat restrictive around food or having some issues with food. I think there the family modeling is a huge piece of it because, you know, children pick up what their families are transmitting about food, and children are actually born as intuitive eaters. You know, when you think back to how most babies learn to eat, right? It's they cry when they're hungry. Mm-hmm. They let you know when they're full by turning their head away, pushing away the nipple or the bottle. They really don't, you know, eat any more than they're hungry for. They might be hungry for weird things at certain times. You know, they end up getting a really huge variety of foods, right? As young children and toddlers and stuff, you know, who are able to eat solid foods, you might see like a kid, you know, only having like milk and crackers at one meal. And then, you know, the next meal, it's all broccoli. And then the next meal, it's, you know, a little of this, a little of that, a bunch of different things, you know, sort of going around and trying and tasting things. And getting their nutritional needs met over like a 30-day period, if they're allowed to just sort of sample and have what they want from a variety that's available. And so parents don't need to be as concerned with, you know, you got to finish your vegetables before you eat this cookie or whatever, because that does kind of set up this dynamic of, okay, vegetables are something that's gross and that, you know, needs to have a reward associated with it. And so, and then cookies are something that's forbidden and restricted and, you know, you can't have unless you do something that's punishment, right? So that, you know, that sort of mentality, which is the way that a lot of us were raised with food, is a lot less helpful than sort of letting kids follow their intuition and eat what they want, you know, and you can encourage them to try things, of course. Like, children's palates develop over time, and so they're not going to love, say, broccoli right away, but maybe if you make it in different ways that are appealing to a child, that give it a little more sweetness or creaminess or whatever, you know, sauces and things like that, that they will, you know, try it at least and maybe learn to like it if given enough opportunities. And so you can say, can you, you know, take a bite of this for me and let me know what you think or whatever.
Yeah.
But if you sort of let them be the guide and say, nope, I'm full, I'm done, and sort of allow them to be full and allow them to have a snack later when they get hungry, because they will, you know, and allow them to tell you when they're hungry and to have that be okay and to feed them when they're hungry, that really helps just preserve that intuitive sense of what they want and need and helps them stay connected to their intuition about food for as long as possible. And, you know, that's really a gift to be able to give kids, is to preserve that connection.
It's so important, isn't it? I think it must be hard. I mean, I'm a parent, but it must be hard, I'm sure, for so many parents who are trying to. They're busy, they've got routine they're trying to fulfill for their family, they've got after-school activities, they're trying to let their kids eat when they're hungry and fit all of that in and be a relaxed parent as well. So I can see, you know, it's not an easy job. And anyone who says, oh, you're just the stay-at-home parent, that's a whole nother topic.
Oh, yes.
Totally.
Yeah, no, it's, I'm not a parent yet, but it must be just, I can't imagine how much you have to juggle, you know, as a parent.
Totally.
And so of course you're going to be just doing the best you can with regard to food as well. But I think that's the cool thing about intuitive eating too, is that, you know, it's actually a lot easier and more hands-off as a way to feed children than, you know, the sort of more involved and fearful approach that a lot of parents are like encouraged to take in this day and age of policing everything that goes into their child's mouth. So, you know, if you can sort of get the hang of intuitive eating and teach that to your family, it does make mealtimes a lot easier and less fraught.
Yeah, I'm sure you're right. And I think also, you know, the issue of social media and all these parents looking at Pinterest and Instagram and the perfect lunchboxes and the perfect meals that are being provided supposedly to everybody else's family, and then judging themselves on how they're parenting depending on what's going on the plate, you know, and therein lies the whole issue of the start of an orthorexia type scenario as those children grow up as well. So it isn't helpful. You know, I know that many people out there put those images up in hope that it's, you know, you're selling a dream, that it's going to inspire people to do better. But in many cases, of course, it just ends up causing people to feel guilty that they're not doing enough.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's well said. It's like, it's not inspiration. It's sort of a stick for someone to beat themselves with.
I know, sadly, I think it is sometimes. Yeah, totally. Hey, look, a couple of things, many things you've said are amazing, but something that I thought was really interesting, because of your journalist background, do you find that when you're looking at things, you've mentioned studies and, you know, various leaders in the field, obviously, of the real food movement and organic food movement, alongside, you know, the studies that are showing different avenues and what happens with regards to people having eating disorders or the correlation. Do you find, as a journalist, you're looking at the total picture, that you're reading what's happening on one side, what's happening on another side, and then trying to come to a conclusion, which I think is amazing, versus so much of what I read now, Christy, which is so people deciding what it is that they're following and then finding every piece of literature that will fit to approve what they've chosen. Do you know what I'm trying to say? Do you think your journalist background has been fortuitous in you ending up coming to this sort of beautiful space of intuitive eating by being able to analyze all the information and then coming to a sort of a really lovely middle ground? Versus what I see, which is a lot of people making a stand in a particular direction and then gathering all this data to, sort of justify their position.
Yeah. I mean, I will say it's interesting because I think my journalistic orientation, like the personality type that I have that made me a good journalist and that made me attracted to journalism, is probably what allows me to have this balanced sense. But I think when I was a journalist, actually, I had no idea how to really read a study. And I think that's something that people need to understand about journalists who write about science and nutrition, is that nobody trains you in how to read a study and how to report, you know, research methods accurately. I mean, some workplaces do this, and you know, there are fellowships for science journalism and stuff like that. But the majority of journalists who write about food and nutrition are just, you know, people in their early 20s, usually, oftentimes, you know, maybe later, but who came out of school, you know, like I did, worked as a journalist, decided on a beat they were going to cover, did the best they could to gather information, and rely on scientists and medical professionals to report them information about, you know, that they're then going to take out to the public. And, you know, medical professionals and scientists can also be very biased, right? Mm-hmm. And if your editor at a magazine or a newspaper or a blog or whatever is telling you, like, hey, we'd like a story on clean eating. This is like a huge fad. And, you know, we want a story to like be clickbait or whatever about this. You know, the editor is already going to have a perspective that they want the journalist to come at it from. Usually most publications, you know, there's some sort of bias already in just how the story is framed by the editor or the journalist pitching the story to the editor in that collaboration. You know, the sort of hypothesis is formed there already. And most journalists don't do a ton of scientific research to build their arguments. They, you know, may see a press release about a new study in like 25 women showing that, you know, whatever conclusion about, you know, X food and Y outcome, mm-hmm. and jump on that, right? And report that as though it were really big news, and, you know, write a headline that's super fear-mongering and quote this study and maybe a few other experts who believe what the study results are, maybe ask an expert who has a different opinion, and then that's that, and that's the story. Yeah. Meanwhile, you know, I learned this more in my public health degree, and I'm so grateful that I did. A study of 25 people has no relevance to the general population, and usually is just a pilot study to show, hey, is there enough evidence here for scientists to do a larger scale study on this topic? And it's meant for scientists to guide future research. It's not meant for the public to change their eating habits based on the results of that study. And unfortunately, you know, I'm using the number 25 just sort of picked out of a hat, but unfortunately, many journalists will report on studies that are that small or smaller and not realize the importance of having, you know, a much larger population size, you know, hundreds of people to draw on in a particular study. And also like I won't get into all the like language about it, but just, you know, what's the word I'm looking for? The only thing I can think of is p-value right now, which is a measure of how likely it is that the result was just due to chance versus that the result was actually due to something real that we need to pay attention to scientifically. And so, you know, if something has a sort of marginally significant p-value, statistical significance is the word I'm looking for, marginally significant p-value, scientists can sort of massage data to get a significant enough p-value that it can be reported in a journal. And then journalists, you know, in the public media will develop, I mean, in the mass media will jump on that research and you know, share stories about it that make the public react with fear to whatever food is being demonized. You know, corn is going to kill you, or chocolate's really good for you. Eat it all the time. Or, you know, red wine is good. No, red wine is bad. Coffee's good. Coffee's bad. You know, these kinds of stories are what come out of a real lack of depth and responsibility in reporting on the science. So I think people need to really take what they read about health and nutrition with a huge grain of salt. Yes. And that's coming from a background of journalism as well as a background of public health nutrition and really looking at the research. And I didn't know half of what I know about how to tell if research is really relevant to the general public. When I was a journalist, I learned that later in my graduate school degree.
Oh, that is so awesome. I'm so glad I asked you that question.
Me too.
That was an awesome answer. I love that. And I'm going to listen back to that and quote it, because it is really, I mean, I'm not a journalist, but I did do a degree and I read avidly, and it just absolutely horrifies me when I watch people jump on bandwagon over a Facebook post and just take that as gospel. And it's so scary. So I'm really glad I asked you for your opinion, because you've got an amazing background there with the things that you have done. I also love, Christy, that underlying everything we've talked about today is your obvious love for lifelong learning, and that you have followed your own journey by just being intuitive as to what is working for you at that time, and then making an effort to go and study that further, and to find yourself where you are now was not what you had imagined at the beginning, but you have just intuitively followed your own lead and then made yourself educated along the way. And I totally love that. And that's what I say to kids all the time. Don't feel like it doesn't matter if you don't know everything now, because you'll probably change what you want to do later anyway, and just be consistently open to lifelong learning. And you obviously espouse that wholeheartedly.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. I really do. And it was a source of shame for a while. Like, oh, I'm not, you know, as entrenched in my career as I want to be, or I haven't just picked one career and stuck with it or whatever. But I think it's actually an asset. And I think it's increasingly common for people to change careers now too. You know, most people I know have actually started in one career and then gone to something completely different.
Oh, totally, Christy. And I you know, I think you're amazing. And I live in a very similar way, in that I've changed, you know, what I've done and different focus. And yes, I've had plenty of people tell me that I'm crazy and I haven't niched down, and why do I keep flopping and changing, and it can't possibly be successful. But I think, you know, if it's right for you, and as long as you're promising yourself to do the best at each thing that you do, not just sort of skimming a surface and pretending to be something or an expert in something when you're not, then I can't see the harm in it. And I love what you do. I love your podcast, which is absolutely amazing. So it's Food Psych. We'll give it the plug. Obviously, I'll do that in the intro as well and in the show notes. And it's been an absolute privilege to have you on The Fearless Kitchen.
Well, thank you so much. It's wonderful talking with you.
Yeah, thanks, Christy. Thanks for listening, guys. What an awesome chat with Christy. I hope that you learned heaps, felt inspired, and enjoyed maybe a cup of tea or a glass of wine while you listened to us, or maybe you were on a power walk and felt inspired to change the way you approach your life and your food, having listened to her and to myself. If you want to find out more about Christy, you can find her online at christyharrison.com. As I said in the intro, her podcast is Food Psych. She also has online courses and loads of information and a blog on her webpage as well, and she's on social media also. What a beautiful person. Thanks for joining us in our chat, and I look forward again to seeing you next week, guys. And I'm really excited because we're coming up to the launch of my cookbook, The Fearless Kitchen, and I'm really proud of it, as I should be, I guess. But it's been such a huge journey, 10 months in the making, so it will be very, very exciting to be able to share it with all of you, to see it on the the bookshelves here in New Zealand and also Singapore. I'm heading up there for a mini book launch and hoping maybe to be able to sell it through some stores in Australia too. So we'll see how that goes. Have a great week, and I look forward to touching base with you next week. Thanks to worldpodcast.com. See you. I'll take what's good.
You're listening to the Fearless Kitchen Podcast and your host, Vanessa Baxter.